Well, good evening, Cornwood.
Good evening.
See you back this Sunday night as we're going to continue in the book of Proverbs. Give me the opportunity, please, and may the grace once again to thank your pastor and my friend for inviting me back here for these hours of Bible study together. I'm an itinerant preacher. On weekends, my card-carrying job weekdays is to teach ministers at Baylor's George W. Truett Theological Seminary, which is one of the 12 schools that makes up Baylor. But other times, I'm a traveling preacher, typically in 20 states a year, this, that, or the other kind of conference, speak about 150 times. But I'm keenly aware that nobody has to ask you to come and speak. Nobody's under an obligation to say, we want you to come here. And I've learned over the years to look at that as a great grace, not some kind of entitlement that I have, that someone would ask me to come and try to impart something in a setting like this. You get to meet people all over the country who know the Lord and see what they have in common in their faith in many different kinds of settings. And that's a great grace. I think about the last 3 weeks. I'm here. A week ago, I was in Springfield, Massachusetts, in Western Mass, in a very diverse congregation that's 175 years old, 175, but vital, full of people, full of the Spirit. Tremendous gathering. And then 2 weeks ago, I was in Newark, New Jersey, one of the really blighted, needy urban areas in the United States. And same thing, very different from the other two places. And one thing it encourages me about is just to see how God is at work in this country. And I like to say encouraging things to churches. If the news reported what God is doing around this country in proportion to all of the other news, you'd be seeing it. I mean that. If CNN, MSNBC, Fox, whatever your choice is, if it were imparting what God is doing, you'd be seeing it. God is at work in this country, and it is newsworthy. It doesn't get there, but I want to give you that word of encouragement, because sometimes we think the church is awash in difficulty or drowning in secularism. I can assure you, coast to coast and border to border, he's at work. Now let's get back into the book of Proverbs. We finished today about the fool. This is number 7 is where we'll begin before our break. The sluggard. It's a great old word. The King James uses that word, the sluggard. It has to do with sloth, inertia, procrastination, the inability to do, to move, to work. Now, first of all, it touches on the absurdity of the sluggard's excuses. This is intended to be ridiculous, and it's meant to sound humorous. A person is supposed to be doing something, but the sluggard says, there's a lion outside. I'll be killed in the public square. Or to translate it another way, the sluggard says, there's a lion in the road, a fierce lion roaming the streets. Now, we're not to understand that there were more lions about then than there are now. This was supposed to be ridiculous. He was supposed to be an absurdity. I can't get out in the city. I might meet a roving mountain lion. Have you ever noticed that when people need an excuse, they can find one? It's one of the realities of life. There was, we'd say a hillbilly, someone up in a cabin. A neighbor came to him and said, neighbor, need you to loan me your axe. And the man who owned the axe said, I'm eating peas. Neighbor said, you don't understand me. I just need to borrow your axe a little while. And he said, I want you to know I'm eating peas. This exchange went on 3 or 4 times, the same thing. The man who needed to borrow the axe finally broke down and said, well, what does eating peas have to do with loaning your axe? And he said, neighbor, if you don't want to loan your axe, one excuse gives the other. And even so, this talks about the absurdity of excuses. During a transition time in my life, of all things, I wound up helping a sales manager for Greenwood Mount Olive Cemeteries in the pre-need sales force. And we'd have sales meetings. I remember one day a salesperson didn't come to the meeting, and I had to ask, why didn't you come to the meeting? And I got a lot of excuses when people wouldn't come to sales meetings, but this one was good. He said, well, I mowed my grass Saturday, and I had to get the grass out of the mower this morning. Now, this was Monday morning. When you need an excuse, it's not that difficult to find one. Jesus dealt with that, if I could be intertestamental a minute, because there's some echoes almost of this in his famous cost of discipleship. That Luke 9, what F.F. Bruce called one of the hard sayings of Jesus. Luke 9:57. You know, Jesus finds somebody. And this somebody said, Lord, I'll follow you wherever you go. Jesus said, foxes have holes, birds of air have nests. Son of Man doesn't have anywhere to lay his head. That person just disappears without an excuse. You know this passage. Then he says to another, follow me. And that person says, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. Now that's debated, but Luke intends us to understand whatever it meant was really a ridiculous excuse. Then 61, he says, Lord, I'll follow you, but let me go and bid them farewell who are at my house. I've wondered about these nameless, incognito, unknown people. Right there with Peter, Andrew, James, and John, their name might have belonged to the beginnings of Christian history. But they gave the Lord of life an excuse. Next parable says, also humorous, revolving in one place. As the door turns on its hinges, so a sluggard turns on his bed. Just the inability to get up, rotating over and over in bed. And the next one is incarcerated in your own inertia. Here's the incremental danger of laziness. A sluggard buries his hand in the dish, and he's too lazy to bring it back to his mouth. Now, if you've ever eaten in that Middle Eastern culture, it's often a shared dish thing. Here's someone who has so much inertia that it's come to the point their hand is in the dish of olives or goat cheese or whatever, and they can't even cover the distance between hand and mouth. It's intended to look ludicrous. You can almost see the person putting his face down in the dish. Next one I call not taking care of business. Here's someone going by, looking at the untended vineyard of a neighbor. I went past the field of a sluggard, past the vineyard of someone who has no sense. Thorns had come up everywhere. Ground was covered with weeds. Stone wall was in ruins. And here's his takeaway. I applied my heart to what I observed and learned a lesson from what I saw. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding the hands to rest. Poverty will come on you like a thief and scarcity like an armed man. Now, if you want to see the opposite of this, look in Isaiah chapter 5, where someone has tended a vineyard. I think there's a deliberate contrast. This is a ballad. Let me sing to my well-beloved a song regarding his vineyard. How did the vineyard look where someone with energy and effort and application worked on it? My beloved has a vineyard on a very fruitful hill. That is, care had been taken. It literally means a hill of fatness, a hill with rich soil. He dug it up and cleared out its stones. If you've ever visited Israel, you know the one thing that meets you everywhere is stones. There was an Arab proverb that when the creating angel fell over Israel, he had two bags of stones for the whole world, and one of them broke on Israel. And it looks that way. Anytime you planted something, it required assiduous labor to dig it, to stone it. And then in verse 2, he planted it with the choicest of vine. The word in Hebrew means the veil of Sarek, the very best vintage. And then he built a tower at great labor and expense. This would mean a rock tower to watch the vineyard to keep predatory beasts away, particularly foxes that would come in and eat the grapes. And then in expectation, out of stone, he dug a wine press. This is something of labor. And down in verse 5, it mentions that it had both a hedge and a wall. That is a double protection. Now, this is what was expected from someone who applied themselves to a vineyard. And it stands in contrast to the lazy man whose ground was covered with weeds, stone wall, and ruins. Might write out in the margin, contrast, Isaiah 5 for industry. I don't know what to say about this other than that it stands on the surface. Proverbs is not the friend of the person who does not take initiative. It's not the buddy of the procrastinator. Now, all of us have items that we want to procrastinate. And this is a word to that. Wesley, John Wesley, founder of the Methodist Church, John Wesley, 18th century preacher that saved England from something like the French Revolution because of the evangelical awakening in England. John Wesley was famous for his industry, and he had a statement that I've remembered. He said, "I owe everything good that happened to me to showing up 15 minutes early." I've found out you can learn things being there. I had a friend who was a preacher over in Myrtle, Mississippi. Had a camp called Camp Zion. Back in the days when Baptists called their preachers brothers, Brother Percy Ray. Very unusual man, powerful preacher, tiny town in Mississippi, Myrtle, Mississippi. Brother Way was an old-fashioned bachelor, never married, gave his whole life to that church. He was always in his study in the dark before dawn. And people say, "Brother Ray, you're getting older. Why are you in there dawn?" And Percy would say, "I have women in this church who pick cotton until their fingers bleed." And he said, "If they're going to be doing that, I'm going to be here when they're out there." That stuck with me decades ago in my own life as a minister. Now we turn a corner here. Another major theme in the book of Proverbs is the friend. Remember, we're looking at themes, and you can trace all of these through Proverbs more times than I'm referring to. How do you deal with friendships? Closeness. You know that... That's a challenge in the life of nearly everybody, even in the church. The closeness that comes with friendship and all of the obligations and mutualities and reciprocals and trade-offs. If you don't want to have any friends, you may not have any problems, but you won't have any friends. Sometimes in the church, friends can be like those two porcupines that got caught out in a snowmass in the Yukon up toward Alaska. They were way off from their porcupine dens and their porcupine houses. And a big Arctic snowstorm came. And one of the porcupines said to the other, "If we don't get closer together, we're going to freeze." But the closer they got together, the more they needled one another. It's that way. Even in the family of God. You heard the little poem, "To dwell above with the saints in love, that'll be glory. To dwell below with some of the saints I know, that's a different story. How do you manage closeness, friendship? I think it's very practical. The first thing is, how do you say and when do you say no to a friend? Well, there's no way to get around this. One place that Proverbs says to say no is co-signing a note. It said, my son, if you have put up security for your neighbor, if you've shaken hands in pledge for a stranger, you've been trapped by what you said and ensnared by the word of your mouth. Now let me give you the background to this. This isn't sitting down there at a desk necessarily at the bank. This was something in ancient society that involved three people. It involved someone that you know, and the implication is maybe someone you know but not that well. A money lender, a Hebrew who lended money, and the friend who strikes hands, shakes hands on the deal to be security for the moneylender, for the friend. That's the picture. Now, look at Proverbs' suggestion. Go to the point of exhaustion and give your neighbor no rest. Now allow no sleep to your eyes, no slumber for your eyelids. Free yourself like a gazelle from the hand of the hunter, like a bird from the snare of the fowler. He's saying, get out of that as fast as you can. If you're standing surety, if you're a co-signer. Can I take a leaf from my own life's journey? I was in my first pastorate. I was a 19-year-old junior at Baylor University. I look back now and wonder, why in the world did those people call me to be a pastor? Little church on the edge of the Baylor campus in the poorest community in Waco, the Edgefield Baptist Church. It was uncurbed, ungutted. Inside the city limits of Waco, people were living like squatters in abandoned substandard houses. Just moving in there. It was tri-ethnically integrated. It was the poorest whites, Latinos, and blacks in Waco, and I was living in the middle of it with all of my 19-year-old wisdom as a pastor. What I didn't know would fill the Encyclopedia Britannica. But I wanted to reach people for Jesus. I said, I'd do anything to reach these people for Jesus. We had a family on the church bus route. The Diocese family, I went out every Saturday, knocked doors just north of Baylor's campus. On Sunday, I'd sometimes drive the bus myself, pick up kids to come to Sunday school. Rosie and her husband, Israel, had seven children. The eighth one was on the way. They didn't have a car. I said, let me know when you got to go to the hospital. Sure enough, time's come. Let's go to Hillcrest Baptist Hospital, race them over there. We were in the admissions area when they stuck a paper out in front of Rosie and Israel and said, you sign here. And then they looked at me and said, now, will you co-sign this? I know what they meant. I signed it. Strange thing happened. A month later or so, I started getting invoices from the hospital, not for one baby, but two. I'd signed on some previous debt they had. I saw my whole life. I said, here, I'm 19 years old, and I'm ruined before I got started because I can't pay the Baptist hospital. I remember I was frightened. Finally screwed up my courage. Julian Pace, the administrator, was a deacon down at First Baptist Waco. I didn't know him. He was a rather austere, foreboding gentleman. I made an appointment. I'm going to throw myself on his mercy. Here I walked in my 19-year-old pastoral wisdom and started to open my mouth. Pace looked at me and said, Gregory, I know why you're here. We've taken care of it. Never sign one of those again. I walked out and it looked like the sun was rising. The wind was in my face. It was a new day. Now, don't shoot the messenger. This is what the word of Proverbs says, that be like a gazelle to get out of it, run to get out of that kind of obligation. Now that's when you have to say no to a friend. Now, when do you say yes? It's not just a negation. Proverbs 3, do not withhold good from those to whom it is due. When it is in your power to act, do not say to your neighbor, come back tomorrow and I'll give it to you, when you already have it with you. This is the opposite situation. This isn't co-signing a note. Your neighbor needs some simple help. You have in your hand what could be of help. There's an Arabic phrase that's often used when people don't want to do that. It's called bukra, and it means tomorrow. It's a way of saying, I'll take care of it tomorrow. Bukra. Proverbs says, don't stain the moment. When you have in your hand something that could simply help and adulterate the moment, stain the moment by saying, come back and I'll help you tomorrow. This likely has to do with what the book of James in the New Testament says when he talks about the wages of a day laborer. That is somebody that's a day laborer. It's the end of the day. Today, you might say, you picked them up down at the Workforce Commission in a panel truck, took them all. They're waiting at the end of the day for a little bit of cash to sustain them till the next day. That would be a scene like that. You say, I'll catch you tomorrow, when you've got it in your pocket and you know they need it. That's the idea behind it. Don't withhold when it's easily in your power to give. Now, the reliability of a friend. We're looking at themes in Proverbs on friendship. One who has unreliable friends, and the word suggests one, somebody who plays at friendship, will soon come to ruin. But there's a friend who sticks closer than a brother. The word in Hebrew suggests the nearest kin. This is a commendation. Beware of unreliable friends. But then antithetically in this proverb, there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. The idea suggests those who play at friendship, people who will chat you up. They have a social flair. Hail fellow well met, but it's shallow. Their friendship is a mile wide, but it's just an inch deep. I think we all know what this connotes, the shallow friend versus the close friend. One of my heroes in ministry is Charles Haddon Spurgeon. Late in his life, he got involved in one of the very large theological controversies of his time that split the British Baptist Union, split it. Some people left, some people stayed. It was a painful event, like some more recent denominational wars. His number one nemesis, theologically, in this was another London preacher whose name was John Clifford. They'd built churches together, they'd worked together, but Spurgeon wound up on one side of a Baptist controversy, and John Clifford wound up on the other side of it. Kind of thing that could strain your friendship. But interestingly, Lewis Drummond, the biographer of Spurgeon, said, even though publicly they were at enmity over the divisiveness of the theological issue, privately they remained warm, close, personal friends. Isn't that interesting? One of the tragedies of my lifetime were those who came to loggerheads over theological issues and found out that it broke the bonds of friendship. It says there's a friend who sticks closer than a brother. One of my colleagues at Truett is Dr. Paul Scott Wilson, Scott Gibson. For 40 years of professorship, Gordon Conwell in Boston, now with us, has mentored students. And when I say mentor, not just while they're with him. He has given his life to mentoring them. He has 33 ministers across this country right now that he has invested in their life for decades. A friend for life. I admire that. It's convicted me about students. There's a commendation of that kind of friendship here in Proverbs. But then the truthfulness of a friend. How does a friend act in truth? Wounds from a friend can be trusted, but an enemy multiplies kisses. A real friend can talk to you bluntly, straightly, but an enemy can give you the Judas kiss. That is, acting like a friend, but betraying. Apostle Paul said, a friend is someone who speaks the truth in love. I've had a chance to try that in my lifetime in ministry. I've been up, I've been down, I've been level with the ground over 54 years of preaching. A memory that sticks out in me is when I was having a particular difficult passage in my life. Reverend Dr. E.K. Bailey was pastor of one of the largest black churches in Dallas, a black mega church in South Dallas. And he sat down with me over on Interstate 20 at a fast food joint because he needed to talk to me about my own life. I had no idea what was coming, but we had to have a serious conversation. I'll never forget the wisdom, Solomonic wisdom right out of the book of Proverbs. As he sat there eating a hamburger with me and looked at me and said, "Jaw, what is the worst thing I can know about you?" Nobody in my life before or after that ever asked me that. It was brilliant. He knew where he wanted to get. He knew what I needed to confront. He could have sat there with his mouth full of hamburgers and French fries and indicted me. But instead he said, "John, what's the worst thing I can know about you?" It became a moment of incredible wisdom, which without indicting me or confronting me, got the issue on the table. The wounds of a friend are faithful. Now, the opposite of that is here the very next thing that you find. Those who flatter their neighbors are spreading nets for their feet. Now, I know, all of us like to be flattered. Kind of nice, feels good for a while to be flattered. Who doesn't like it? You tell me you don't like to be flattered, I'd probably say you lie about other stuff too. You know, I mean, people like to be flattered. But Proverbs is straightforward with this. It says those who flatter their neighbors are laying a net for them. Unctuous people who flatter everybody are spreading a net. Sometimes it better. You know, presidents always have their portrait drawn. Big moment when they unveil presidential portrait. Remember, Calvin Coolidge had a nickname. Remember his nickname? Silent Cal. Because he never said anything. He's famous for not talking as president. The Presbyterian went to church one Sunday. When he came back to the White House, Miss Coolidge hadn't gone. And she said, "Well, what did the preacher preach about?" Cal said, "Sin." She said, "Well, Calvin, what did he say about it?" "Opposed." Anyway, when his portrait was unveiled, he was looking at it, and he looked, And his friend looked along with him at the portrait. Neither one of them said anything. And finally, Coolidge said, "I agree with you." I am trying to learn as a professional talker all over again the fact that God put two guards in front of our tongue, our teeth and our lips. And this is a warning that leads us right into number 9. The power and the impotence of words in Proverbs. It is difficult for us to understand the power that Hebrews attached to words. I remember even in Sunday school hearing the story when Jacob and his mother Rebekah fooled poor old blind Isaac. Remember that story? I remember being a little boy in Sunday school. Remember Isaac blessed Jacob because he was a trickster. And when Esau came in and found out Isaac had blessed Jacob, he couldn't bless him. I remember sitting there in Sunday school thinking, man, why couldn't he just take it back? Just, I didn't mean the first one, I mean this one. It was because of the Hebrews' belief in the power of the word, the Hebrew word dabar, the power. When a word went out of your mouth, it was a charged unit. One of the silliest untrue little statements of sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. That may be the dumbest thing ever said. Couldn't take it back. The Hebrews saw when a word left your mouth, it had a charged, almost kinetic, energetic effect. So, look at the impact of words. The human spirit can endure in sickness, but a crushed spirit, who can bear? A broken spirit. The words of the reckless pierce like swords, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. And as a result of that, anxiety weighs down the heart, but a kind word cheers it up. The power of our words. I remember a time in my own life, like I said, I've been 54 years trying to minister as a seminary student, having some challenges. And I remember walking across the campus of Southwestern Seminary. There's a beloved dean there, long gone to heaven now, Dr. Hubert Drumright. From way across the campus, he yelled out at me, one out of 4,000 students, they just yelled out, "Hey, hi, Joel." I think that was about 1972. To this day, 47 years later, I remember that day when I sold down and Hubert Drumright, who knew 1,000 students, called me by name, and words have power. Know how to use them the right way. Dr. Hal Warlick, for a while, was pastor at 7 James in Waco. When I was chaplain at Harvard, ended his career in South Carolina at a school. Told me that when he was a student at Harvard Divinity School, there was a wealthy professor there who every year invited students over to his house. A wealthy professor sounds a little like an oxymoron to me, but there was a wealthy professor. This guy was independently wealthy, had a beautiful estate, and he had a formal dinner. What he did was, the students from the previous year would sometimes help him host the next year. Now, I called Hal to verify this story years after I heard him first tell it. I said, "Is this true?" And he said, "Absolutely." When he helped the professor host this formal dinner, there were some students very nervous. Like most of us of modest means, they didn't exactly know what the cutlery was for, this fork, this knife, this glass. They were nervous. This wealthy professor collected demitasse cups, little cups for espresso, and he just brought back an exquisite set of porcelain demitasse cups. And there was a young woman there at dinner, so nervous that when they served the coffee after dinner, she dropped this valuable antique cup. Hal Warlick said, "I felt a strong kick on my shin." Said, "I almost yelped out, I felt another kick." And he said the professor took his cup and threw it into the fireplace. And Hal said, "I felt another kick and another one, and it dawned on me, he wants me to throw my cup in there." He said, one by one, the students around the table, eyes wide open, breath abated, threw their cup in the fireplace. He said, then the wealthy professor said to this young woman who was so chagrined and embarrassed, "How did you know about the ritual of the breaking of the cups? Did someone tell you about it?" Of course, she looked shocked. And she said, "I didn't know anyone told you about our ritual. At the end of the semester, we all break the cups to indicate the semester's over." Of course, he made that up on the spot. But Hal, after it was all over, said, "I went to the wealthy Harvard Divinity professor and said, 'Why'd you do that? Those antiques cost a fortune.'" And he said, the famed professor said, "I can always get some more cups, but I could never restore that moment to that young woman." I heard that story in the 1970s. I called Hal several decades later and said, "Would you tell me that again? Did that really happen?" He said, "Yes." And for Hal and for me both, it stayed in our mind, the power of the right word at the right time to keep somebody's spirit from being crushed. You know, I'm glad a few times as a preacher, professor, colleague in the ministry, God's given me the opportunity to edify. You know, a good thing to ask yourself before you say something is a simple question. Does it edify? Does it build up? If we'd pause, and God knows I try in these days of life and ministry, does it build up? It's a beautiful passage here, the power of words. It's interesting also the power even of nonverbal expressions. If you look at chapter 6, 13, I don't think that made it on your outline, but in 6:13, it just talks about a worthless person, wicked man, walks with a perverse mouth. He winks with his eyes. He shuffles his feet. He points with his fingers. Non-verbal communication. I've been struggling with somebody lately. As petty as it may seem, powerful. Trying to keep some folks together. One of the biggest problems is sarcastic eye rolling. You know, eye rolling? It's almost broken down a relationship. Rolling of that. The power of nonverbal. I deal with young preachers teaching them how to preach, and I try to say, if you're talking about the love of Jesus, smile like he loves somebody. Don't be like this and say, "Jesus loves you." Because people are going to believe what? They're more likely to believe how you look than what you say. So Proverbs underscores the significance of nonverbal communication in friendship. You know, I talked this morning twice. I don't now. And just like the Spirit whispered to me on the way driving over here to give just a minute, if it's all right, Mike, just for some Q&A question. You know, and I don't claim to be an expert in wisdom literature. Tried to spend some time thinking about this. own degrees are in New Testament, so I'm kind of swimming at the other end of the pool when I'm in Old Testament. But Q&A, something would occur to you, a big question about the nature of Proverbs or anything we've said about it. Are they all King Solomon's? No, actually, what you have, if you look back from, I think it was this morning, and I can't even remember if I mentioned it, I may have mentioned it quickly, on the second page where we read the movements, 1:1 through 9:18 are largely narratives, they're attributed to Solomon. 10:1 through chapter 22:16 are one-liners from Solomon. 22:17 to 24:34 are different viewpoints, but if you look at chapter 25, you find that you begin a collection of further wise sayings from Solomon. You see that there? But then by the time you get down to 30, at the very end, and we'll see that after our break, there are the words of Augur, A-U-G-U-R, whoever that was, talks about being sayings, the words of Augur, A-G-U-R, the son of Jairus. So at least at the end, there was a collection of some other wise words from some old Hebrew. But I do believe Solomon's the responsible source for most of what you find here. And the ancient church did, and the Hebrews did. It's one reason it got into the canon of Scripture. It's a whole other thing. How did books get in the Bible? A lot of other books floating around. They called pseudepigraphical and apocryphal books. They were religious books. And the rabbis had a council at Jamnia up in Galilee to pray about and decide which of the books got into the Hebrew Bible. For example, Esther barely made the cut. Esther was drafted in the last round. This actually recorded debate because the name of God never appears in Esther. They finally decided God was active in Esther, so it got in. And Proverbs had some challenges for that same reason. You don't really read the history of the God of Israel. You know, these are a whole different thing from anything else in the Old Testament. I suppose that Augur and others got in because they felt they were wise sayings too. Yes.
So, who was the audience for? So Solomon wrote these.
Yeah.
Did they read them in the synagogue, or was it just kind of open square reading? Or
open? No, I think you did right there. I think it was an oral tradition. My belief, and that is some others, if you can't imagine, here are Hebrews sitting in the gate. The gate was where the wise elders of the city would meet. These gates were kind of complicated affairs, and they had benches around them. And the idea seems to be that the wise people would sit in the gate, and they'd just spin these out, almost like sitting around campfire. And they just exchange these one-liners as the wise people who sat in the gate. That meant they really acted as kind of permanent civil jury for civil cases. You'd come to the wise men in the gate. And the background seems to be an oral tradition. They just sit around a campfire and spin these out. And I can see them. They're inspired by the Spirit of God. But they'd say, you know, here's what a friend is. Yeah, nice. Something like that. And they were collected, likely, by somebody else and out of that oral tradition and put in place that we have today, at least 3,000 years ago. Any other questions? Well, let me say again, these are wise, but you wouldn't want it to be the last word. Because they act like, in a sense, law needing gospel. They put me in trouble, because I can tell you this, I haven't lived by all of them, and that trouble means I need help. Which of us doesn't know better than we do? So these are in a sense good advice, but good advice that leaves me in trouble unless I have the power to live them out. That's what Paul means in Philippians 3. He said, I was a Pharisee, I kept the law perfectly. But then he was frustrated because he still fell short of things like this. And he said, you know, I need power. You need, so I want to emphasize, we're not leaving here tonight saying I'm just going to grit my teeth and clench my fist and I'm going to go out and live like the Proverbs. You won't get out the door till you break one of them. No, they're a signal that we needed more. We needed the saving life of Christ. And great promise that if when we were enemies, we were justified by his death, how much more we'll be rescued, saved by his life. The only hope I have to live these Proverbs out doesn't rest in jaw. It rests in throwing myself on his mercy and grace and asking for his power. So, you know, we're not going to, our life doesn't stop with these Proverbs. They point us toward the one that we need. Yes, sir.
I think you just answered my question.
Yeah.
This morning you were talking about how we are not to treat Proverbs as if it's promises.
Right.
I guess my question was, in the work of Christ in our lives, does that begin to change somehow because his power is working through us to make these things possible?
Yes. Yes, indeed. Indeed. And that's a good question. This morning I said the Proverbs are not a book of promises. And that is, they're how life usually works. And that's not my private opinion. That's it. In other words, particularly one of the troubling ones I mentioned this morning. If you raise up a child and the way it should go, old he won't depart from it. That's generally the case. But all of us in life and church have seen some exceptions to that. Period. So it's how things usually work. But you're right. They drive us. It's like what happened to Paul and the law. Paul was a Pharisee. He was serious about trying to keep the 613 subdivisions of the law of Moses. The Pharisees had divided the Ten Commandments into 613 subdivisions. Negative prohibitions and positive admonitions. Don't do this. Do this. I mean, some of them were nitpicky, like if a fly is crawling around on your face on the Sabbath, don't slap it because you're working on the Sabbath. Or don't drag a chair across the room on the Sabbath because you might move some dust and that would be plowing on the Sabbath. The rabbis even argued about how far you could walk, a Sabbath day's journey. And Paul grew frustrated because he was one of the few people in the country that could even remember the 613 things. He finally threw his hand up. He came to that great realization, the just by faith shall live. God intended his law, like I said this morning, J. Vernon McGee's mirror. You don't clean your face by rubbing it on the mirror. Everything in the Old Testament calls for change of conduct. No less the Sermon on the Mount. Drive us toward grace. I remember when I've tried to witness people and they've told me, I've lived by the Ten Commandments. I remember telling one kind of tough guy one time, that's interesting because Billy Graham said he broke 9 of them. Or I've had people tell me, I live by the Sermon on the Mount. Really? Have you read it? All law puts us in trouble so we know we need grace. And then after grace, there's help. Does that get at what you're saying? I hope so. Yeah.